Blog Talk Radio.
We are the heirs of that first revolution.
Will a strong and united America still be a force for freedom and prosperity around the world?
America has created the longest peacetime economic expansion in our history.
We are the heirs of that first revolution.
Good common sense and sound judgment of the American people and their essential love of justice.
Hi, welcome to the Kudzu Vine for September 22nd, 2013. I'm your host, David McLaughlin, and joining me this week, welcome Catherine Smith.
Hello, everyone.
Yes. Well, I got some news to report to everybody, and you may not have heard me welcome Tim Shiflett this morning, this evening. Tim emailed me on Tuesday, and I was actually coaching a football game when I guess it came through, and I, you know, saw it on the bus ride home. We had won. We beat a team we hadn't beaten in 5 years. Just so excited, and I get this news, and it just kind of took the joy out of the wind almost, telling you how big it was. Tim said that he wants to step away from politics in a pretty major way. He holds a party office in Chattooga County. He's going to continue to do that through this term, but then every other political thing, he wanted to go ahead and step away, and he wanted to make a break pretty immediately. He said in future days, it'll all make sense, you know, what he's got going on. But so obviously, Catherine, I respect his opinion or his prerogative on that. But the show's going to change. It just can't be the same with somebody as quality and talented and knowledgeable as Tim Shiflett leaving it. He's been on almost every single episode for over 6 years. When I started this show back in 2007, I mean, it was kind of a crazy idea, but some people at the party said, yeah, you do it, but you do it, not the party. And they said, find some people that you think will be good, that you trust. The first phone call I made was to Tim Shiflett, and he said, yes. He, Scott Aikman, and I muddled through that first week, and we just kept getting, you know, better and better. And I think I got a little better, but I think Tim started out better and just got even better, to where he was many weeks just the highlight of the show, be it his outrage of the week or the fact that he'd always keep it straight with the correct numbers on polls and everything else we brought up. Catherine, I'm not sure if you've talked to Tim this week, but I'll let you give your thoughts on Tim.
I haven't had a chance to talk to him, but I have to tell you that that phone call made me very sad when you called me this week. You know, I've always thought that the three of us have a really nice balance of both personality and information and perspective to Southern politics. You know, Tim always had an amazing historical memory, you know, of you know how things had happened in, you know, decades ago, as well as you know, keeping up with some of the national right wing blogs that and what was being discussed there, and as well as being just a great guy and always, you know, asking good questions and just, you know, all around great guy. So I'm really sad. I mean, I know we'll struggle through and we'll figure out a different, maybe a little bit different approach to some of this stuff. I'm still here. I'm not going anywhere. And I know David feels the same way, but we are saddened, but, you know, optimistic about making some changes and honestly hoping that at some point Tim might come back and visit from time to time, but I'm not counting on that. It sounds like he's making a clean break, and I can completely understand wanting to do that. I'm not at that point right now, but I understand how sometimes you just feel like you need to make a clean break, and I support him, and whatever he's got going, I hope it makes him happy and is successful for whatever it is, and I'm sure, like you said, we'll find out more about that in the coming weeks.
Yeah, you never say never as far as him coming back, but He said something's going on that we'll understand more later, and so I've always trusted Tim, so I'll trust him on this one as well, and we'll see. And, of course, we wish him his best on whatever future endeavors there might be. He said there had to be a break from politics, and that may become important on something else with Tim as well. But, you know, we just have to move on. And we've talked about, Catherine already planned ahead, we're going to try to have more guests, like we have instead of guest hosts from out of state. Because, of course, we do a pretty good job on Georgia politics, but because we don't live in Virginia and Arkansas and Texas, if we can then have those folks on to be our guests. But then also sometimes a lot of these folks, just like us, find, you know, the Kentucky Senate race interesting, find the Florida's governor's race interesting. And so we may do that to bring in some new voices. And, of course, we've had just so many good people on, when particularly you and me, Catherine, can't be on instead of Tim, because our attendance is just not Tim's. I mean, he's, I guess, the
really?
Lyric of the kudzu vine. Like I said, I mean, it's like if it's 2-3 times, that's really what it is. So that's going to be the biggest shock. I'm going to have to work harder because I can't lean on Tim to run the board as much at times. I'm going to stay tied to my computer because sometimes I'll say, hey, kind of watch while I do the show walking around doing some other things. But that's okay. And tonight we got something big going on, and this was planned even before Tim told us. David Neer of Daily Kos Election should be calling in just any minute. But until he does, Catherine, I want to go to something that's really your wheelhouse, and we need to, of course, start relying on your strengths and my strengths, and that's DPG Elections. You know, obviously there were some things going on, the fact that it was in Newnan, maybe some of the Newnan city officials getting involved, but it seemed pretty cut and dry that DeBose Porter won the election. It was time to move forward, and forward's a big word in Democratic politics nowadays, but apparently some people want to kind of hit the little repeat button and say the election's not over. Tell us about what's going on there.
Well, I don't think that's exact. That's probably how it appears, but I really don't think, from what I gather and from the people that I've spoken to, there's been a request to review the ballots. And that's perfectly within the guidelines and rules of Democratic Party elections. Party elections are always open, never secret ballot. And so they a couple of people have requested to review those ballots, and that request is being honored. There was a little bit of brouhaha in the paper last week. I don't know exactly how it got to be drummed up to be such a big deal. I have spoken to one of the people that I was on the elections committee, so of course it kind of drew my curiosity. You know, is there some question about the election? Is there? But I've been assured that there's really no question about the election, that it's just a standard request. You know, there was some discussion at the election, some confusion from some newer participants about the way in which we cast our ballots. The rules call for a roll call vote, which traditionally is where people stand up and say who they're voting for, and, you know, we keep a tally by that. Over the 10 plus years that I've been involved in the party, we have not done roll call votes in that fashion. We've always had printed ballots where you put your name, you print your name, and you print your congressional district. It's a printed ballot with the various candidates. You vote for your candidate, you sign the ballot, you submit it, and then the counting team counts all the ballots and presents the results. That's the way we've always done it.
Yes, and I've been on the counting. Yeah, I've been behind the curtain, if you will. Actually, I was, I guess, a representative of one of the candidates one time, so I've been behind
right.
there one time. And, you know, everybody's watching. It would be very, very hard for somebody to do anything fishy with the ballots at that time. Because you got...
Right, in this case,
easily
each ballot was checked against the roster of, you know, attendance, and then, you know, with the signature and, you know, checked the signature checked against it, and it each ballot was voted, was counted, in essence, 8 times by various methods. You know, we had 2 counting rooms. They each count. They split the votes in 2 piles. Counted them twice. You know, it was all. We had a very specific strategy to make sure that each ballot was counted correctly, and we didn't have any challenges from within the from the observers who were watching the count. There were like 2 ballots that were sort of in question, but just because they had not printed their names, they had just signed. But we resolved that by comparing their signatures to the roster, and so those votes were not challenged. Very, very few problems. But apparently that method was not what some of the newer members of the state committee were expecting. They thought it was going to be a roll call vote in a traditional way, and so they believed that it was a change in protocol, and because of the change in protocol, they wanted to review the ballots. We've sort of clarified that it really wasn't a change in protocol, but it's a perfectly legitimate request, and you know, we're doing it on Saturday, and I don't expect it to cause a challenge to the election. Everyone has said they support the DuBose-Porter as chair 100%. This is more of like a housekeeping. They view it as like a housekeeping event.
Yes. Well, hopefully that'll be the case and folks can move forward. So we know in Georgia, Alabama, and a few other Southern Democratic parties, we just need to get focused on the business of building the base and winning elections. Well, I want to welcome into the show our featured guest of the evening. Welcome back to the Kudzu Vine, Mr. David Neer of Daily Kos Elections. David?
It's a pleasure to be here once again.
Yes. Well, there's just so many good races, and a lot of that stems from the fact that there's been good Democratic recruitment. I sent you a laundry list this week, David, of races I'd like to talk about, and I just have a funny feeling we're not going to get to all of them, but let's talk about the newest one first. That we had a top-tier candidate come into, that being the West Virginia Senate race. Kind of tell us what the lay of the land is there.
Sure. So in West Virginia, longtime veteran Senator Jay Rockefeller announced his retirement earlier this year. And as political observers know, West Virginia had long been a Democratic bastion, but in recent years has really, at least on the federal level, taken a hard turn toward the right. And Republicans succeeded in recruiting a top-tier candidate of their own, in fact, before Rockefeller even retired, Congresswoman Shelley Moore Capito. But Democrats went a long time without successfully landing a candidate to try to replace Rockefeller until finally, just the other week, Natalie Tennant, who is the Secretary of State and a reasonably prominent figure in her own right, decided to make the go for Democrats.
Yes. Now, where does that leave the race? Because I think people thought Capito would have won the race if a good Democratic candidate didn't get in. Probably the best candidate for the party that got in, you know, jumped in. So is this a 50-50 proposition that, or is it a little more uphill than that?
You know, I wish I could answer your question tomorrow rather than tonight, because public policy polling is in the field this weekend with their first ever poll of West Virginia this cycle. And I think everyone who watches this kind of stuff is very eager to see what those results look like. There really has been very little polling. I don't think it's a 50-50 bet, though, for Democrats, unfortunately. Like I said, the trends don't really favor us in West Virginia. And Barack Obama did particularly poorly there last year. However, that was also Barack Obama, and there seems to be a particular hostility to him in certain places, West Virginia being one of them. At the same time that Obama was getting destroyed, Senator Joe Manchin was going on to a very powerful reelection statement, and Governor Earl Ray Tomlin managed to hang on, though by a much smaller margin, only about 5 points. So it's hard to get a read on West Virginia, though I do think that at this point, given the state's conservative trend, I would say that Capito has the edge over Tennant, though I certainly would not rule Tennant out. I think she will definitely be able to raise a lot of money, and this is going to be a serious race.
Yeah, I think you're right about the way trends stop at the border of West Virginia. We had Drew Pritta on about 2 weeks ago from Arkansas, and he talked about how, you know, the president was never real popular in the state among, like, swing voters and Republicans, but then voters will cross over in statewide elections, and West Virginia follows that model. One more question about this. I heard something that this would be a groundbreaking race, and that, if I'm not mistaken, it's the first time that two females will face off for a U.S. Senate seat, of course, major parties, that is not held by an incumbent. Do you know anything about exactly what the history-making potential is here, or did you see the same thing I did?
That's an interesting statistic. I hadn't heard that, but, of course, now I'm busy racking my brain trying to see if I can come up with any counterexamples, and I can't. There definitely have been instances of two women candidates from the major parties opposing each other, but I think, like you said, those have involved incumbents, and, of course, this is an open seat. But I think that notion aside, the problem that Republicans have had nationwide is, even when they're running women candidates, is appealing to women voters, many of whom are not interested in the Republicans' extremist agenda when it comes to matters that are often important to many women voters. West Virginia, of course, it's a more conservative place. It's a pro-life state on the whole. And so I think that someone like Capito is not going to wind up as the next Todd Akin, but I do think that Tennant is definitely going to have an advantage with women, and I'm not really sure that Capito will be able to cut into that.
Yes, and of course, I guess Georgia, if Karen Handel were to be the nominee, and Michelle Nunn, because she has primary opponents as well, they could, I guess, tie it in a way, but obviously a much more competitive primary situation here in our state. Well, I'm going to pass it to Catherine. And, Catherine, we sounds like we covered West Virginia pretty good. Just take any state you'd like to talk about.
Well, I'm going to actually ask him a different question.
Good deal.
Sorry.
Okay. No problem.
So, David, I was looking at Coase today, and I saw this sort of, pardon the expression, dump of census information, which I find really interesting, and I'm wondering if anyone at Coase, or if you know of anyone in any of the states or campaigns that is comparing this, taking this information and comparing it to voter information, because this is just basic census data about primarily about minority census data. But I think it would be really interesting to take this and compare it to voting data, like with NGP or VAN or whatever. Do you know of any plan to do that, or?
You know, the world of big data is kind of can be very opaque, because folks have their secret sauce and they don't necessarily want to give advantages both to their competition and to the other side. So I have to say, I don't really know. The census did just blast out a whole new swath of data as part of their annual American Community Survey, which goes into much greater detail than the decennial census form. And it really does provide a lot of interesting data. All I can say is I am sure that the sort of companies you mentioned, like Catalyst, I can guarantee you that they're busy crunching this data the minute it comes out, because we're looking for every possible demographic edge and sort of analytical edge that we can find. And, you know, it's one of the most amazing things about the census is that they produce all this amazing data and they make it available for free.
Yeah, because it's really it'll be really fascinating when we layer on, you know, all the demographic shifts in various states and the what we call the new American electorate and all this, you know, it really adds a whole lot of texture to the efforts being made to, you know, get people to actually vote. I mean,
absolutely.
Which,
you know,
is,
and I think,
you know, shocking in itself, but anyway, I just wanted to note that it's really amazing information, and thank you for setting up a nice little Google Doc for me so I can look at it.
Our pleasure.
And for anybody who's interested, there is a really nice Google Doc that the folks at Daily Coast set up, and you can find it at Daily Coast/elections, I guess.
Elections.dailycoast.com will take you right there.
Yeah, and anyone who's listening who wants to look at this information, it's fascinating. I always like looking at my, you know, I have the great fortune of having Congressman John Lewis as my congressman, so I always like to check his demographics. But anyway, back to, have you had a chance to look at what's happening in Georgia, as long as we're talking about, as long as I'm talking from Atlanta, how do you think the clown car of Republicans, and now we're sort of building a little clown car of Democrats in the Senate race. Have you had a chance to look at that?
Certainly. You know, it's the GOP primary has been pretty fascinating and fun. It's the kind of primary I think that Democratic strategists always wish for. There was a piece in Politico, it was thinly sourced, but claiming that because Representative Paul Brown is so absolutely crazy that more establishment Republicans were thinking about going negative on him on the airwaves in the primary just to try to prevent him from winning so that they don't saddle themselves with, to bring up the name again, another Todd Akin. So I don't know if that'll actually happen. I sort of pray that it does, only because I suspect that if Paul Brown gets to say that the establishment is spending all this money attacking him, that'll make his supporters even more energized, and I think give him an even better chance of winning that primary. But that's definitely a fun race.
Well, you know, Phil Gingrey's not much less crazy than Paul Brown when it comes right down to it. I mean,
and that's the beautiful thing. We have so many wonderful choices to choose from.
Yeah, well, I've heard a couple people say that they're thinking about crossing over and voting in the Republican primary to vote for Paul Brown. And I keep saying, you know, you got to be careful. Be careful of what you wish for, because God forbid he actually won. You know, they think that if we go up against someone like, if the Democrats go up against someone like Paul Brown, we'll have a much easier win for, you know, everyone thinks it'll be Michelle Nunn. But I'm always afraid that, you know, they might end up in that crazy one might end up in the Senate. And I don't know about that.
That's always a legitimate fear. But I think if you're a Democrat, especially a Democrat running in a red state, you have to take your chances. Claire McCaskill would not have had a shot had Todd Akin not been the nominee. And in fact, she actually spent money to run ads to try to help Akin become the nominee by claiming he was too conservative. It was a very crafty little attack that she did. And then, of course, conservative voters hear some liberal calling Akin too conservative. Well, that made him sound wonderful. So, you know, yes, Brown could wind up in the Senate. That would be a tragedy for Georgia and the country. But I think if Michelle Nunn is to have the best chance possible, you got to root for Paul Brown if you're a Democrat.
Okay.
Yeah, sometimes. Yeah, in sports, sometimes they say it's not about your guys, it's about their guys. And in this case, it'd be who the Republicans put up, and you have to find somebody beatable. And of course, we found out this past week why Phil Gingrey's so anxious to join the Senate. He said he's stuck here making $177,000 in Congress. I'm sure there's a lot of folks that like to be stuck making $177,000. Did that get any play outside of Georgia, David?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, it definitely did. You know, I wrote about it. It certainly tore up the progressive media, and I think also the Beltway media. It's just one of those real foot-and-mouth things that politicians just, can be very clueless and not realize what people in the real world actually make for a living. And it sounded pretty darn tone deaf. Gingrey claimed that he didn't remember making the remarks, so he didn't even deny them. I would have to bet that he almost certainly said this. And the real question is, are some of his opponents in the primary going to try to use it against him? I think it could make for an effective attack just to paint him as out of touch, which he clearly is.
Yes. Well, let's kind of move on to another state to kind of go around the region. In Florida this past week, I think, you know, people know Rick Scott's pretty unpopular. And I got the sense a lot of Democrats thought, well, you know, we can beat Rick Scott with almost any good Democrat. So why don't we not get desperate and hope that Charlie Crist is our only hope, and maybe like an Alex Stink can run again and, you know, win the governorship for us with a real Democrat, if you will. She said she's happy in private life. Does that make it more likely that Charlie Crist will be the Democrats' best hope, or are there other options?
I sort of find it hard to get a read on Crist, though there were some reports suggesting that he might want to delay an announcement as long as possible to give Rick Scott as little time as possible to attack him. I think that if Crist gets in, I think he will be the nominee. I think he probably really wanted to avoid a hard-fought race with Sink. I don't think Democrats can really afford an expensive primary because Scott obviously is supremely wealthy on a personal level and is also raising a ton of money for his reelection too. And so a Crist versus Sink primary, I think, would have left the nominee both wounded and penniless. And now whoever the nominee is, like I said, I think it'll be Crist if he gets in, will be able to kind of hit the ground running after the primary. And I think that's what you have to do in order to beat Scott. He's unpopular, but he's rich as hell.
Yeah, and of course, Rick Scott defeated Charlie Crist before, so he's probably got a ton of opposition research. The only problem is the side in which Charlie Crist will be attacking him from, and he'll be attacking Crist, is totally the opposite. He can't just run to the right much like Marco Rubio did, you know, to kind of box up. Actually, he replaced Crist. He didn't defeat him. It was Rubio that defeated Crist with that right run to the right playbook, which, you know, he can share that oppo with him. So that's what changes the game there. So there are no other Democrats on the horizon looking at that race, seriously?
You know, there's State Senator Nan Rich has been running for quite a while. She sort of seems to be frustrated that she's not getting any traction, or not getting a lot of traction, and that a lot of Democrats are still waiting on Crist. There are always, you know, we talk about the great mentioner. There's always people getting mentioned. You know, who's mentioning them? Reporters, pundits, you know, operatives. But that doesn't necessarily mean they're genuinely interested. And you see this happen from time to time. When you have a big name waiting out there like Crist, or if you want to look at the Montana Senate race like former Governor Brian Schweitzer there, you know, it just makes everyone freeze in place because you don't want to jump into a race only to find yourself getting swamped by someone with much greater name recognition and much better fundraising connections. If Crist doesn't run, then I think you'll see sort of a lot more chatter, but I think he's put a freeze on the chatter for now.
Yes, although if I were someone that was trying to move up in politics, maybe you run, you try to raise what you can, but you keep your overhead very low. You spend very little of your money as you're raising it. You go around the state, make a ton of connections. Then if somebody that's the 800-pound gorilla in the race gets in, you can always drop out, and then either you get to keep what you raised or you give it back, but you still know how to, you know, make those calls again, and you've raised your profile without expending any real political capital. And so I think that, you know, this state senator, Nan Rich, ought to keep going for it. In case he doesn't get in, then she becomes the candidate. And if he does, she could, you know, quietly bow out for the good of the party, and it's kind of a win for in that way. What do y'all think?
Yeah, no, I agree. You always have some – there are always a few people like Rich who are willing to take that plunge, even in the absence of perfect information, and those people should be saluted because, you know, again, like with Schweitzer, sometimes your big fish doesn't get in the race and you need to go with plan B. And I think if Crist doesn't get in, Rich will have the leg up simply because she's been running the longest.
Yes. Well, let's continue to go through some of these races. Catherine, if you want to jump in and ask about any of our states, because we've got a lot of U.S. Senate races, some governor's races, feel free.
Well, I'm sure we're going to talk about Virginia, right? I mean, Virginia
is the big. At it, Catherine. You asked the question. You set the table.
Well, the race between Cuccinelli and what's his name? McCullough.
Terry McCullough.
Terry McCullough. Yeah,
sure. You know, that's become an interesting race. Cuccinelli has been trailing in all of the recent polls. And Republicans seem to be getting really nervous about this one. He just seems to be firing up his own base while at the same time kind of scaring a number of independents and also firing up Democrats, which is kind of amazing because Terry McAuliffe is not the sort of person to inspire a lot of progressive ardor, but sometimes running against a good villain is the best thing you can hope for when you're
running. I'm sure that Terry McAuliffe is pleased with some of the crazy talk that's been going on between, I mean, it's not just Cuccinelli, it's the guy running for lieutenant governor too. From my perspective, they've managed to pick two sort of deadly candidates I hope they may have buyer's remorse because I think the two of them together, and are there other ones too that are just kind of wacky? But those numbers are looking good for McAuliffe, right?
Yeah, like I said, you know, Cuccinelli hasn't led in any polls in a long time, and if Republicans have any internal polls that show anything different, well, they haven't released them, and now would have been the time to do so. And, yeah, you know, E.W. Jackson, the lieutenant governor nominee for the Republicans, is also definitely hurting the ticket. It seems like it would be pretty surprising if he managed to win. Certainly, he can only hold the ticket back.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
is there a Senate race? Yeah, he's been quiet. They haven't tied up in an office somewhere, or hasn't come up with anything crazy to say in the last couple of weeks.
So, you know, Virginia Senate race won't be until next year, and that'll be Democrat Mark Warner is running for re-election. And he's just been a dominant figure. Republicans have absolutely no one running against him right now. They have no one serious even considering a run against him. And you Georgia folks will certainly like this. You may have seen it yourselves. Some Gingrich staffer for Newt Gingrich, created a PAC to try to encourage him to run for Senate in Virginia, which is just comical on so many levels. Obviously, Gingrich is a Georgia native, and his only ties to Virginia stem from the fact that, you know, it's in the orbit of Washington, D.C.'s beltway.
Yeah, that's
not good when you're trying to run for
Georgia Senate. Yeah.
Go ahead, David.
Well, let's go ahead and talk to another Senate race. I tell you what, probably to me, maybe the most interesting Senate race in the country, because it's just, you know, cuts to the core of the Republicans' leadership and soul, if you will, is the Kentucky Senate race. Mitch McConnell has been the party leader in the Senate for just years. I mean, I think I was probably in high school when he took over. he's just been a major figure in their Senate leadership for just decades now. And he has probably the first real challenge of his career in, you know, Allison Lundgren Grimes. And her, you know, poll numbers show she's within striking distance. Are those polls fool's gold, or is it really that close?
I think she has a legitimate chance, Allison Grimes. And the best part about it is that McConnell is really being squeezed from both sides because he doesn't just face a legitimate Democratic challenger. He also has to fight off a legitimate primary challenge in the Republican primary from businessman Matt Bevin, who appears to be reasonably wealthy and appears to be able to self-fund. And the two have already been going at it hammer and tongs on the airwaves. And it's the worst of all worlds for McConnell because he has to prove his conservative bona fides, his Tea Party bona fides, if you will, in the primary. And the more that he does that, the more unappealing he makes himself in the general election, even in a conservative state like Kentucky. And there's also something else here to consider, which is that this race is going to happen in a midterm election year. And Kentucky, sort of like West Virginia, which we were talking about earlier, is one of those places which seems to have a special dislike for Barack Obama. Ordinarily, midterms don't favor Democrats. Democratic turnout is higher in presidential years. But the flip side is Barack Obama won't be on the top of the ticket. And that gives Grimes a chance to distance herself from the president and to sort of chart her own course, to define herself as an independent Democrat. And I think that McConnell could definitely lose, and it would be a one for the ages if he does.
Yes. Now, we've seen polling on the you know, general election matchup, have you seen any polling on the primary, David?
McConnell released an internal poll that showed him with a comically outsized lead. I can't exactly remember, maybe 40 or 50 points, except the pollster that he relied on, I have to say, their public releases, the few that they've made, have been absolutely bogus. You might remember the primary in 2010 between Trey Grayson, the establishment candidate, and Rand Paul, who was very much a libertarian in the mold of his father. And McConnell's pollster at the time put out a poll shortly before the primary saying that it was neck and neck, and Rand Paul went on to absolutely crush Trey Grayson. So I don't trust the pollster that McConnell used for his internal poll. And also, it's really, really early. Nobody knows who Matt Bevin is. And like I said, Bevin seems to have the money to compete, and he'll increase his name recognition. I think, yeah, there's a non-zero chance that McConnell could not be renominated.
Yeah, I mean, it'll be interesting to see. Maybe if somebody like Harper Polling or Rasmussen Reports or somebody does a poll that, you know, somebody really knows that Republican side of the aisle, that will get a better read. Although, do you think some of the more well-known pollsters that do public polling are afraid to poll on this race because they don't want to necessarily cross the leadership with their findings?
You know, that's an interesting thought. I think that we are not likely to see too many Republican internals surface except for ones actually paid for by either McConnell or Bevin. So maybe you actually need a PPP, which is a Democratic-affiliated pollster, to go in there and take a look. And I suspect they'll be in there before long with some numbers. But I think it'll be a while before we have a true sense of whether McConnell is really threatened. So I wouldn't want to read too much into early poll numbers just to make a comparison. The early poll numbers in the 2006 Democratic primary for Senate in Connecticut showed Joe Lieberman cruising to renomination, and he wound up losing the primary to Ned Lamont. So give it some time. We'll see.
Yes, well, staying on that Kentucky Senate race, one more question. Allison London Grimes, her campaign kicked off pretty disjointed, but then the polls came out. It was more than one, including the PPP poll, that showed her doing pretty well. It didn't seem to hurt her. But then the race has been a little quiet the past few weeks, maybe even say months at this point. Have things stabilized? Has there been any real action going on this race, or is this just collect money and shake hands behind the scenes?
You know, reporters reacted unhappily to Grimes' announcement, and as a partisan, I didn't think she pulled it off very well. But sticking a bunch of reporters on a hot summer day in a room without air conditioning and then making them wait and then not taking questions, you know, that's probably going to tick them off. However, voters don't care, especially not a year and a half before an election. No one was paying attention, and it was one of those classic things that maybe the Beltway cares about, but no real human being voter actually does. I think that McConnell's probably been pretty distracted with Congress being back in session. He had Syria to deal with in particular. Not that he wanted to, you know, definitely Grimes has the chance to, like you said, since things are sort of more stable, go out there, raise money, raise her name recognition, while McConnell can't wait because he has to deal with this primary. So she has the benefit of being on her own for a while.
Yes. Well, guys, I think we've just covered all the Appalachian mountain races. any state that touches this in the Appalachians in the South, we've covered their governor or Senate races. Let's move on to some other ones. Catherine, you want to ask about any of the other hot Southern races?
I'd just like to hear which ones you think are interesting, David. What are beyond what we've talked about, what do you think is what's, you know, drawing your curiosity in the South?
You know, I'll be real curious to see if Democratic Senator Mark Pryor can hang on in Arkansas. I think he may be the most vulnerable incumbent this cycle. I think, again, it's because of the where trends are going in Arkansas, similar to West Virginia, and he also drew a top-tier opponent in Republican Congressman Tom Cotton. So And also, like in West Virginia, it's a state where we've seen almost no legitimate polling. So it's one of these races that's, again, very hard to get a read on. If Mark Pryor wins next November 2014, then I think there's no way that Republicans have managed to take back the Senate. On the other hand, if he loses, it doesn't mean that Democrats have lost the Senate either, because I think if he loses, he might be the first to go. I think he, Senator Mark Begich in Alaska, and then another Southern Senator, Mary Landrieu, are probably the three most vulnerable incumbents running for re-election. That doesn't mean I think that they're the Democrats' most vulnerable seats. For those, I would have to say the West Virginia race, Montana, and South Dakota, I think, are more vulnerable than prior, but those are all open seats.
Oh, I see.
Yes, we had a guest on 2 weeks ago, Drew Pritt from Arkansas, and we told this on the show, he's one of the most optimistic guests we've ever had, but he said that he didn't think Tom Cotton was a very good candidate, that he was actually struggling in his own congressional district. And then he said people just seem to like Mark Pryor. They kind of detach him from the National Democratic Party more so than a lot of Democrats can do. Now, I think that playbook used to work a long time ago. I think it works less and less every cycle where you say, hey, I'm a different kind of Democrat. I'm not like Washington. I think people kind of see the unity top to bottom, so it's almost – better to run with your party sometimes than against, but maybe it still works in Arkansas. We shall see. Well, let's move one state south, and Mary Landrieu, who just wins races about closer than anybody in U.S. Senate, in the U.S. Senate, I guess she's trying to go for her fourth term, and she's never really just, knocked one out of the park. I think the last one was probably her easiest one, if you will. Better than 96 in 2002. Where does her race stand?
That's an interesting race. PPP has polled there a couple times, and they have shown her in surprisingly good shape, better than I would have expected, with around a 50-40 lead over Republican Bill Cassidy, the congressman who is the establishment choice to take her on. She's not going to have an easy race next year, no doubt about it. But there was an interesting sort of thing that happened the other week, just a minor little detail. Republicans ran an early ad against Landrieu, trying to they used the old Nintendo game Duck Hunt. Do you guys remember that game?
Yes, oh, boy. I saw the ad. It was it was kind of cheesy, in fact, but it was run, I guess, on Duck Dynasty, which I guess at least had a hook, if you will.
Right, and that's exactly it. They were running it on Duck Dynasty. But the thing that someone pointed out to me was you have an ad based on the theme of this hunting game on a show about hunting that wasn't actually about guns, which was fascinating to me because Landrieu voted in favor of increased background checks for gun buyers, which prior, one state to the north, didn't do. And Republicans acted as though this vote was going to be Mary Landrieu's death knell, but background checks poll very, very high in every state in the nation. Louisiana is no exception. And so the fact that they're not touching Landrieu on guns means that maybe she's a bit smarter than they think she is and that she might outfox them yet. So I don't want to say optimistic about her chances, but I think that she could very well hold on.
Yeah, so it'd be interesting to watch, and obviously that's one the Republicans want pretty badly. Well, we've covered pretty much every, major Senate race in the South. Now, y'all on Daily Kos Elections had a piece on the Texas governor's race. We know Rick Perry, we just don't see how he can run again, although Greg Abbott, the sitting attorney general, is looking at that race, and he's probably more popular than Rick Perry. Run in Texas, but the piece on Daily Kos Elections said, while it looks like an uphill climb, don't count Democrats out. Where do you think that race stands?
Perry actually said he wasn't going to run for re-election. So it's hard to know whether that's a good thing or a bad thing. I think that Wendy Davis, the state senator who Democrats just recruited into the race, might have preferred to run against Rick Perry thanks to his high negatives, but that's neither here nor there. She's almost certainly going to face Greg Abbott, the attorney general, who has $20 million in his campaign account, just a ridiculous sum. Davis, mind you, she hasn't actually formally announced yet, but she's given every indication that she will. You know, she has a tough calculus. She only narrowly won re-election to her state Senate seat last year. Republicans tried to screw her in redistricting, and they were turned back in the courts, but she still doesn't have a great district, and she would have had to run for re-election to the Senate this year. So she was facing a tough race either way, and I think she is following from the school of striking while the iron is hot, because she became a progressive rock star overnight with her filibuster of the Republican abortion bill earlier this year. And she could wait for the demographics to change in Texas, because they are changing. But at the same time, she'll never be more famous and more popular among the activist base than she is right now. I think Abbott is still a strong favorite to win. But, you know, he's capable of screwing up. He's certainly extremely, extremely conservative and can put his foot in his mouth. And I also think he wasn't expecting to have a serious contest. And Wendy Davis is going to give him a real run for his money. That's the other thing to point out, and I know I'm going on for a little while here, but, you know, in these one-party states where you get accustomed to winning these statewide elections without much opposition in the general election, all of a sudden, one day, someone comes along from the other party and gives you a real run for your money. Maybe you're not expecting it, and maybe they can steal a win out from under you.
Well, and that's what I always say we need to be ready for. And my impression of Wendy Davis is that while she might not have as much money as her opponent, she is raising money all over the place. If the number of emails I get from various progressive organizations are any indication, and if they are you know, proving to be successful, she's raising money. She must be doing pretty well, because I'm getting emails, you know, from everybody telling me to support her. So
yeah, she'll have money, you know, and like I say, if she waited 10 years to do this, she might not have had those same connections that she does now and the same enthusiasm. So she is capitalizing when she's at the peak of her stock is at its peak.
Yeah, well, and that was interesting. You made the point about her state Senate district, because that's kind of a thing that, you know, just the average person just following politics sort of closely doesn't know, and somebody like yourself can bring that to our attention, because obviously that kind of gave her the push, I guess, to jump in the race. Now, one thing that is the plus and the minuses, if you will, or I'm just asking if it is, obviously she's going to raise money because she was introduced for standing up for something she believes in, and that's going to help her raise money. But how is she going to be able to, or do you think she is going to be able to say, look, I'm not all about abortion rights. I'm also about, you know, economic development, education, protecting the environment, because obviously Texas has a lot of dry area, which water resources are big in, transportation in places like Dallas. How does she make the move to say, hey, I'm not Johnny One Note, I can, you know, talk about other things?
That, I think, is going to be the central question of the race, assuming she gets in, because Republicans obviously would love to paint her as some radical who, you know, wants to force every woman to have an abortion. And Davis's number one challenge will be to do it exactly as you say. Part of that is the money that we've been talking about, you know, having the chance to get her name out there, define herself before Abbott and the Republicans can define her and get up on the airwaves. And also part of it is having a good strategy with the press and the public. And I think she's shown that, boy, does she know how to work the press. She's extremely telegenic. She's friendly. She's obviously extremely smart and well-spoken. And, you know, I don't know Greg Abbott personally. I don't know Wendy Davis personally. But, you know, if she can woo reporters and if they wind up liking her better than they like Abbott, which I could very well see happening, that'll help make sure that she gets a chance to tell her side of the story.
Yes, well, David, we spent all this time, we've covered pretty much any statewide race of note in the Senate and the governor's race, but we know that, you know, you started in Swing State Project, and your niche a lot of times was those swing congressional districts. Right? Now, if Catherine and I started just calling out numbers, we just wouldn't even get through anything in the last 10 minutes here. You tell us, what are some of the key congressional districts to really watch for? And you can take them one at a time. Don't feel like you've got to tell us 10 right off the bat.
Sure. Well, the one thing I want to say, because I ran into this problem one time when I did your show, I left off a Senate race in the South, and some commenters who listened, they gave me some help for it. But I don't want to forget the North. I don't want to forget the North Carolina Senate race, which is another important one, where I think that Senator Kay Hagan, Democrat, has a slight advantage there. But let's talk about the House races. You know, I think there's one very interesting race in North Florida. Florida's 2nd Congressional District. Have you guys been following this one, the Graham race?
Yes. Well, Lindsey Graham. You're talking about Lindsey Graham in South Carolina?
No. Bob Graham's daughter running for Congress in Florida's 2nd Congressional District.
Oh, Florida 2nd. No, I'm sorry. When you said Graham, then I got to thinking, yeah, I did leave off the Senate race, although I'll go ahead and give you some cover. David, Kay Hagan's got that thing. That's why I didn't bring it up. But
Fair enough.
Should have talked about Lindsey. But let's talk about Bob's daughter in Florida. That one's really one that kind of got past me. Catherine's probably all over it, but tell us what you know.
Sure. So Florida 2nd, it's in the Panhandle region, and it has sort of conservative leanings. It's reasonably close in the presidential level, maybe almost a little bit of a Dixiecrat district, you might call it. And Democrats have what they feel is a really strong recruit in Gwen Graham, who is the daughter of former Senator and former Governor Bob Graham, who has sort of a very esteemed reputation even today in the state of Florida. She hasn't run for office before. She's not a public figure. So, you know, with candidates like that, you never know how they'll handle themselves in the stump. Can they run a campaign well? But obviously, a name like Graham is golden. And the congressman there is Republican Steve Sutherland. He won only pretty narrowly last year against a very underfunded opponent, Al Lawson. The concern there right now is that Lawson might want to run again, and if he does, he could conceivably win the primary, thus denying Graham a chance at Sutherland. He hasn't made up his mind yet. Democrats are hopeful that Graham will be the nominee, and she could definitely give Sutherland a very stiff race.
So are we going to have like a Southern Sisters little theme going on? We're going to have Michelle Nunn and Gwen Graham stepping together
and
in South
and
Florida.
And Allison Grimes? We'd certainly like that, wouldn't we?
Yeah.
But, you know, it's like we were saying before, it's no accident that Democrats have been recruiting more and more women. And, you know, it's the percentage of women who hold posts in Congress compared to their, you know, the fact that women are half the population. It's obviously a shameful statistic and needs to be remedied. But at least, you know, we have some very prominent women candidates this cycle running for the Democrats.
Yes. Well, so that's in Florida. And obviously Florida is a state where, you know, Democrats will do well and we'll boost our numbers in the House and then we'll lose some seats and we'll fall back. There actually are some swing districts in Florida as opposed to other states. Why do you think that is? Is it just the change in demographics or just that Florida's districts get drawn a little more competitively, I guess you'd say?
You almost said the word fairly, and I don't think I would ever accuse Florida Republicans of doing anything fairly. They were in charge of the redistricting process last cycle, and they definitely tried to draw things to maximize their advantage, but every party does that. I think that in Florida, it's simply a big state, and it can be hard to gerrymander in a very big state in such a way that you don't ensure at least a few competitive districts. Now, that said, Texas Republicans did an extremely good job of minimizing the number of competitive districts there. So part of it are obstacles, including, I don't want to say an obstacle, it's an obstacle for Republicans. Part of it are things like the Voting Rights Act, which require districts that allow minority representation. I don't know. It's a good question why Florida seems to have some swingier districts, but it's certainly not for lack of Republican ambition.
Yeah, and I almost did say fair, but really, you know, the Democratic Party is just as bad about, you know, races that can't be lost by incumbents in either party. And I guess in my mind, since we're kind of the underdogs here in Georgia, most districts fairly means just are just getting a fighting chance. Like, you know, a 40% Democratic district almost seems fair at times just because you'd have a chance to at
least in Georgia, that's a swing district.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. I mean, that's what pastors prepare these days. Well, that's in Florida. Any other, I mean, and this is how crazy and short the list is. David, any other congressional races we need to discuss?
Sure. So I'll just take a very quick tour around the South. So there's a few others in Florida. Florida's 18th, that's Democrat Patrick Murphy. He's the guy who beat Alan West last year. He's going to have a very tough race. That's a slightly Republican-leaning district. North Carolina, you guys are probably familiar with Mike McIntyre. He held on to a very conservative district that Republicans gave him in redistricting last year to try to screw him over. He won by just a few hundred votes. He faces a rematch from the guy he defeated last year. That's going to be a real barn burner. Obviously, in Georgia, you have John Barrow, the survivor, who also another redistricting victim. He managed to hang on by a pretty sizable margin, though, and Republicans have seemed to have a really difficult time recruiting against him. They wound up with a very poor candidate last cycle in Lee Anderson, and they haven't landed any of their big fish. Most of their top-tier hopes against Barrow have declined to run this cycle. So I don't want to say that Barrow is going to escape, but it seems like he has a pretty good shot at getting reelected.
Well, that's partly because we have these open congressional seats because of all these guys who are running for Senate. So they're giving up their congressional seats, like Gingrey, Brown, Kingston.
Yep.
Is there another one?
Yeah, no, there's going to be a lot of action in those GOP primaries.
And John Barrow is just a very savvy politician, so I guess we're starting to learn. There was some data that showed that both John Barrow and Jim Marshall at the time, who hung on several times in tough races, every time they had served a district or served a county in their district for multiple elections, they would get better and better every time. And so I guess now John Barrow is going to have had every county in his district for more than one cycle. And so that, if that holds true, then, you know, he'll do better in all those counties, making it tougher. Well, that's kind of the Deep South. Anything maybe west of Texas, north of Tennessee or Kentucky, anything like that?
You know, I don't think there's going to be too many interesting congressional races in Kentucky or Tennessee this cycle. Democrats kind of want to try to take back Ben Chandler's seat in Kentucky's 6th district, where I think perceptions about Obama's stance on coal probably really hurt Chandler. It's still a pretty conservative district, though, and I think that'll be very tough to take back. In Texas, you probably have really only one competitive seat, the 23rd. That's Democrat Pete Gallego, who beat a Republican, Kiko Canseco, last year. I think Republicans want to try to take that one back. That's a swingy district. Gallego seems to have settled in pretty well, though, and I'd mark him the slight favorite to return next year. Gerrymandering has taken away a lot of competitive races in many of these states. You know, South Carolina, nothing. Even Virginia is not really likely to have a top-tier competitive race, though it might. to do a run around the South, it takes less long than you might expect, which is a little bit sad.
The Senate races are longer, and of course, if you're like us, you're just born up the wrestler Kane didn't seek the U.S. Senate seat against Lamar Alexander in Tennessee, but maybe that'll get good, and we'll have you on another time to discuss it. But, David, I don't know if you heard at the top of the show, but Tim Shiflett is not going to be on the kudzu vine because he's got other things going on. So that was a pretty big blow to Catherine and I, but having a guest of your quality on softened it just a little.
Yes, exactly. Well, thank you.
Well, those are very kind words. I'm very sorry to hear that Tim is not able to be involved, but I hope he's doing well, and I really appreciate you guys having me on again. It's always a blast.
Okay, well,
yeah,
thanks
well,
a lot.
Thank
have a good
you.
Evening.
And we're going to keep reading Daily Kos online. Again. Well, Catherine, you know, all things considered, good show with David on, and thanks again for him being on, and we'll just keep trying to go across. One little note, next week we won't be on the air. I think you're in Washington, D.C. I'm going to be at the Georgia Dome, and so we decided to kind of take us a little break to regroup, and we're going to come back on October 6th with Lowell Feld of Raising Cane from the state of Virginia. Until then,
well, thanks a lot, and I'll talk with you in 2 weeks.
Sure thing.
Good night, everybody.
Bye.
We are the heirs of that first revolution.
Will a strong and united America still be a force for freedom and prosperity?